That was great. I believe we can say amen and go on home. We got a great speaker here, though, and we don't want to do that. I've had the opportunity to hear him several times, and looks like I kept running into him in the Georgia State Convention and down at Charleston and Myrtle Beach and over at Pine Mountain, Georgia, and up at Blue Ridge. And I've heard it looks like some time ago one of these things, Joe shows up, and he's a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous, does a lot of work in the fellowship, and he's one of these people that walks the walk rather than talks the talk. And Sterling W. told me, Joe's buddy up in Greenville one time, said, if you got a real good speaker, you don't have to worry about introducing him. He said, all you got to do is open the chute and let him come out. He'll come out talking. So y'all help me welcome him.
Thank you, Alan. I hope all of you got to meet Margaret. Margaret and I go to a lot of meetings together. Margaret and I drove down from Greenville for Wallace and Hazel's birthday. I think the award ought to go to Hazel for living with Wallace this long. And I was just sitting here tonight looking at the boys as they came up and realized how happy Hazel was that they looked more like her than Wallace. You ever thought about that? But it's good to be here. It really is. For those of you that I don't know, I am an alcoholic. My name is Joe Fulmer. Hi, everybody. And I'm going to tell you why I'm here tonight. Cam and Francis read about it. They read about it in the 12th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, our recovery program. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I almost got confused about this meeting, and I'm going to tell you why. It was the 5th of March, and as I wrote this down, my wife misplaced the notepad that I wrote it on. The 5th of the month in March and April is kind of special to me because 11 months and 29 years ago, I attended my first AA meeting in Louisville on the 5th of April, and I couldn't remember if it was the 5th of March or the 5th of April because the 5th of April sticks out in my mind so much. That night, I was like just about everybody who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was argumentative. I didn't believe what I heard. I thought I was too young to be an alcoholic. I didn't think I was bad enough to be an alcoholic. I'd long since quit picking at people that if I got that bad, I was going to quit drinking because pretty soon I was drinking with those people I picked out just a few months ago. Some of you might have done that. But I think sometimes that it reminds me of a story about the old drunk who got run out of town, and he was walking along the railroad tracks trying to get out of town, and in the dim wee hours of the morning, the headlights of the train blared down on him, and like a lot of us, he thought, well, I might just end it all, but, you know, he said he might get hurt, too, so he looked around to get off the track, and he found out that there was he was on a trestle and didn't know how far it was to the ground, and that he grabbed a hold of a cross tie. And swung himself over the side and hung there. The train lumbered across, didn't quite knock him off, but he found out he was too weak to pull himself back up on the track after the train got by. And he just hung on for dear life. And this is the way we were like this old drunk. About 6 o'clock, when it got light enough to see where he was, he found out that the entire time his feet were about 18 inches from solid ground. Now, it made him so mad he hung on till 11 o'clock. That's about the way it is with most alcoholics. You know, I grew up over here in Saluda. My dad came back to Saluda about 1916. He built the water plant over there. He built an ice plant. He built an electrical generating plant. I grew up over there. There was absolutely nothing in my childhood that made me want to drink. Nobody in my family drank. I'd heard that my paternal grandfather did. He died when I was 6. I never saw him drink. So I don't know, I was just different from everybody else. I was named after an uncle who lived down here at Ward. His name was Joe Herlong. Some of you may have known him. He had 2 sons, Rudolph and Paget. They're both gone now. But I grew up in this area. I did a lot of drinking over here in Johnston. I remember an old policeman that used to be downtown here named Edwards, I believe his name was, and he knew my father. He used to call my father and said, keep him out of there. We're going to have to lock him up. And I hated old man Edwards for telling on me, you know, just because I was tearing up the town or something, there wasn't any reason to call my father about it. I didn't think it was anything bad anyway. But I just grew up that way. And it's odd how life takes a strange turn. Hazel's talking about dreams not turning out like you want them to sometimes. Up until the time I was about 12 years old, I was fully convinced, and people had made plans for me to become a Lutheran pastor. That's what I wanted to do. I can remember a Sunday morning, an Easter Sunday morning, when we had a sunrise service at the old Mount Pleasant Lutheran Church there in Saluda. The pastor's name was Fisher, and the sunlight came through the stained glass window and shone on his face, and I just knew that was it. But about a year later, Joe, for some reason, slipped off with a bunch of guys from school, and we went down on the highway towards Lake Murray, and we bought a six-pack of beer, and I started drinking beer. And I remember that first drink as well as it was yesterday. I think alcohol does something for alcoholics that nothing else in this world does. In a few minutes, everything I'd wanted to be, I became. And I didn't like the taste of that first beer, but I'm going to tell you what, I'd have fought you for the second. It turned me on, and I'm going to tell you how I drank. I drank too much. I drank it too fast. I got sick and passed out, but by God, I woke up a man. That was the whole story right there. And alcohol solved a lot of problems for me when I was coming along. It really did. I was working for a guy that ran a drugstore over there. I showed Margaret that little store this afternoon. It's not a drugstore anymore. Two doors up the street was a grocery. Both of these men, they were old men. They were probably 31 or 32. They were going to teach this kid how to drink, and they tell you this with this admonition: Joe, if you learn to space your drinks, you can even have some brief moments of pleasure in between times of throwing up. I never learned to do that. You know, if one's good, two's better, and that's just the way it goes, and that's the way I drank. I remember getting in a car one night in Batesburg. I dropped this boy off at his house. We'd been out for I don't know how many hours, but we were drunk, and I drove back to Saluda, and I had my first blackout. I was 17 years old. I heard a guy talk years later at the Arkansas State Convention. Some of you from Augusta may remember him. His name was Dr. Tom F., and he had been a doctor in a hospital that had treated alcoholics, and he said if you ever had to pick out something where people crossed the line in alcoholic drinking, it was when they had the first blackout as a result of drinking. And I thought about that. He said, you could never predict what you'd do once you started to drink after you'd had a blackout. And as I look back on my life, and I thought about this a lot, I never set out to drink to get drunk. I got drunk in spite of myself, you know. This obsession to drink we talk about, this compulsion, ran my life for the better part of 20 years. I got out of high school over there in the middle of World War II. Volunteered for the military. That's the first evidence of insanity, isn't it? You volunteer in the middle of a war. Army was good to me. They sent me to school at the University of Mississippi in Auburn, and I got out of Auburn about the time the war was over. I went down to Camp Wheeler. They were training people for the invasion of Japan, and we stayed down there, and the first night at Camp Wheeler, I spent it in the post hospital. You know, big shot like me knew all I did about drinking. We bought some hooch. I don't know what it was, but the rule was if it's too thin to chew, you drink it. And we drank it, and we all ended up in post-hospital. I almost died from that thing. But you don't learn much, you know. You're young, you get back on your feet, and you go about your business. I re-enlisted in the regular Army before I got sent to the Pacific, and they turned me back around from the West Coast and sent me to Europe. And if I lived to be 1,000 years old, I'd never find a place that I could drink like I drank in Europe. I was 18 years old. I was buying cigarettes out of the post exchange for 50 cents a carton. If we could get to Berlin, we could sell them for $200. But if we didn't get out of Frankfurt, they were only $50. But even at $50 a week, with whiskey at 10 cents a shot, you can't drink up $50 a week. We tried, and God knows we almost made it, but we never got rid of the whole 50. It was terrible duty over there. We were the honor guard at the United States Forces headquarters at the IG Farben complex in Frankfurt, and we did military government work. And we had to pull 6 hours of guard out of every 72. That's 6 hours out of 3 days. And that got to be a tough schedule. A lot of us didn't get to work. It's just, it's bad. And, I don't know, I got back to the States in, 1946. Our regiment was a regimental combat team that was assigned to the 82nd, and we were disbanded, and I went down to Fort Bragg with the 82nd when they were reforming and stayed there a year until I got out. I met a gal in Fayetteville. We married in 1947, and like Hazel, she's still with me. I don't know why. She's hung it out all these years. We've had a pretty good life. I got out and came back to South Carolina, went to Clemson, finished Clemson in 3 years in a hurry, wanted to get out and make a lot of money, retired before I was 30. I'm sure a lot of people got a good education at Clemson. I suppose I did, but the thing I remember the most about and used the longest was a recipe I got for homebrew from my next door neighbor. He was a chemistry professor. We could make that stuff check almost a little over 11% alcohol. There would be nothing left in the bottom of the bottle. It was a lot better than beer, and it cost us 3 cents a bottle. And we made a lot of homebrew. I drank a lot of homebrew at Clemson. I got out and came to Greenville and went to work, and my story is not too unusual, I suppose. I got into sales right away. The first year I was out of school, I had 4 jobs. Now, you know, no place was good enough for me. I don't know what the best place for me would have been, but none of the places I was at was good enough, so I just changed about every 3 or 4 months. And got in finally into a company selling office machines, business machines, calculators. And I stayed with that company for about 10 years. And I remember being disillusioned at the end of that first year. You know, I'm about 24 years old now, 25 years old. And things were just not going well at all for me. I decided I wouldn't drink and try to learn something about this company's business. And I didn't do anything for about 60 or 90 days. I studied hard. I worked hard. I learned a little bit about the business applications of these machines. And then the worst possible thing that ever happened to somebody like me happened. Along in the summer of, I believe it was 1952, I sold an order to the old Dixie Home chain, which is now Winn-Dixie, and I got a commission check for $3,000. Now, $3,000 in 1952 was an awful lot of money, and somebody like me shouldn't have $3,000 because you might not know I had $3,000, and that was important to me that you know I had $3,000. And the second evidence of insanity popped up. I went out and bought a new car, and it turned out to be a Studebaker. Now, you know that ain't very smart. But that's what happened. And I drove around in my Studebaker to these watering holes that I frequented. And, you know, I'd stand up there, and I'd have my check stub in my back pocket or my coat pocket, and I'd let it fall out on the bar. And if you didn't see it, I'd push it over under you until you did see it. And somebody'd want to know what that was, and I said, well, that's my commission check for last week. See, I had people thinking I made about $3,000 a week, and for somebody who wants to be a big shot in the first place, that's almost as good as having $3,000 a week. The thing got bad in Greenville. I started back drinking pretty hard and starting to miss days at work, nights at home, and don't ask me where I was. My wife used to ask me, and I didn't know, and if there's anything to make somebody mad, ask them where they were, and they don't know where they are. And I had a chance to move to Charleston and take over an agency down there. I had the whole coast of South Carolina. And I moved to Charleston with the resolution, firm resolution, that I wasn't going to drink like I did in Greenville. They had open bars in Charleston. You could go in there and buy a shot, drink it, go home, and just don't have to buy a sack full of liquor. Let me tell you what I found out about the bars. It just cost more to get drunk a shot at a time. That's all. That's the way it worked out. I used to start to Beaufort. I had a lot of business down at Parris Island Marine Base. That was a 2-day trip. It'd take me about 10. I could not get back from Beaufort. Those Marines drank as much as I did, and we just loved it down there. And I sold a bunch of stuff at the Marine Base. And then I got to staying home. I found the Mine Force Base there in Charleston, and they didn't have any machines, and they had 2 people like to drink, and I sold them a bunch of machines. Got my little office placed almost first in the country down there for the year or two that I worked there from government sales. And the people I drank with all the time. You know, you could send them the calculators out and say, this is the stuff you bought last night. They wouldn't know the difference either. We had a heck of a time in Charleston, but I got sick in Charleston. I didn't know what in the world was wrong with me. I just got sick and couldn't hardly move. I had gone to a number of the Lutheran pastors that I knew in town. They would talk to me about drinking, and I'd tell them I just drank socially. You know, I don't know what social drinking is, but that's what I'd tell them. And they said, well, just don't drink so much. I nearly died trying not to drink so much. I ended up over at the Medical University Hospital, and these doctors, with all their scientific wisdom, after several days of examinations, determined I had an allergy. And I found out a few years later in AA what the allergy was, but I got 2 shots a week for their allergy for the next 2 years. I'll never have it. I don't know what it is, but I got 2 shots a week for it. I got so disgusted in Charleston with me, basically, that I told my boss that I was going to quit. I had to get out of Charleston. The job was too much. The climate was bad. All this stuff we use as excuses for not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And he flew over. He was in Atlanta. And he said, I'm going to move you if you'll stay. And I said, well, where are you going to move me and when? He says, I'll move you today if you want to Huntington, West Virginia. Well, now, I would have preferred Nome, Alaska. I wanted to get as far away from everybody I knew as I could get. I just didn't want anything more to do with anybody that knew me or that I knew. I just knew if I could get with new people and start over, I'd be okay. And I think I would have made it in Huntington, except for one thing. I always had stumbling blocks. I don't know about you, but you know how curious we are. I was staying in a hotel there, and right next to the hotel was a state-operated ABC store. And I know we used to drive up from Greenville to Asheville and buy whiskey because it was cheaper in North Carolina than it was in South Carolina. And I went into the ABC store in Huntington, West Virginia, simply to do some comparative shopping. That's the only reason I went in there. I just wanted to see how the prices there compared to North Carolina. That was basically the reason. And some slick-talking state employee sold me a bottle of whiskey. And I think if he hadn't done that, I probably never would have taken another drink. I thought about that for years. But Huntington, for some reason, got worse than Charleston. I don't know what it was about Huntington. I had begun to drink in the morning in Charleston to get to work, and I began to drink now to stay at work. I began to wake up in the middle of the night having to have something if I was going to get back to sleep, and things got just stinking in Huntington. I went off on a business trip, went down to Portsmouth, Ohio to deliver some machines. I had a big commission check in that thing, and I got almost home. And I stopped to have one bottle of beer. I had to be sober when I installed these machines. And some character I met in this bar, just going to have two beers. You know how we are. And about 3 hours later, long beers, he decided that he had to take me to the horse races with him the next day over at the Keeneland track in Lexington, Kentucky, because, as he said, I've never met anybody who knew as much about horse racing as you know. And in fact, I'd never been to a horse race, didn't have anything to do with it at all. I knew a little bit about everything you want to talk about. So this guy and I leave, and we go to the horse track. And I don't know, there wasn't anything doing in Lexington in the evenings. And after we had our whiskey sours for breakfast, we got up and went to the track. And, of course, we were in Cincinnati. That's where we went for the evening's entertainment. That's only a few hundred miles up there, you know. And we just commuted the whole week. And sometime Friday, Saturday, I don't remember when, but we got back to where I'd left my car in this little town in Ohio, and somebody, some unscrupulous person, I hope he wasn't a drunk and needed a drink, but he broke into the back of my car and stole about $3,000 worth of machinery I had back there that I was responsible for. Well, now, this created a dilemma. I didn't know how to tell the people that owned this machinery where I was when it was stolen, whether I was at the track in or out to the nightclub or whatever. I just didn't know. And I went home and thought about this thing for the weekend, and Monday morning I sent a telegram from my home office, which was out in California, and reported the machine was stolen, and sat there and waited on the axe to fall. Now, I tell you this part of my story for a reason. I think there's times in the life of every alcoholic when they can quit drinking for family, job, or whatever, for some reason other than themselves. As we find out later, that's why we really have to quit. But fear of losing this job, I didn't drink any. 1 month, 2 months, right through Thanksgiving and Christmas goes by, and things were pretty good. And somewhere around the 1st of February, I get a telegram from the home office stating that don't worry about them, they will insure, just be more careful in the future. When I ought to have been relieved, but I remember my thought when I read that telegram. I've wasted 90 days. Just wasted 90 days. But, you know, I hadn't drank for several months there, and we'd gotten real active in the church, and you know how active we can get in churches when we need to get active in churches, and I needed to get active in the church. They were about to give me a key to get in when I wanted to. I think some of the widows in the congregation were about to take up a collection and send me to Gettysburg. That's where the seminary was up there. I really got holier than thou. I'm telling you right now, I did. I was at the foot of the cross right then. I got so active in that thing, and I worked. I worked hard. I just, I think the hardest thing to do once you come into alcoholics is learn how to relax with yourself, and I couldn't relax. I just had to be working, had to be doing something. I got in every civic and fraternal organization, and I worked in my little office in 1957 and 58, placed first in the country. And I was so proud of myself for not drinking that I almost sprained this arm from patting myself on the back about it. I tell these guys that I used to drink with, well, if you had willpower, you wouldn't have to go through all that mess again. I believe that stuff. Long in the spring of 1959, we had a little business show for a couple of days in Louisville, and I took my service manager with me, and we drove over to the business show. And I went to Louisville to drink a bottle of beer. That's why I went. You know, common sense dictates that if you've gone 2.5 years without a drink, one drink won't hurt you, right? That's just common sense. And sitting in a tavern there on Chestnut Street, I drank a bottle of beer. And I want to tell you that from my own experience, I believe that alcoholism is a progressive illness because of what happened to me. In less than 3 weeks, I was drinking just as much and more as I was the day that I quit drinking. It was hurting me worse, and everything that happened to me before was happening again, only this time it was worse. If you want one thing you can hang on the disease of alcoholism, it never gets better. It always gets worse. And I had a mess with that thing. It was a real mess. Boy, it hit me so hard. You know, my little office had done rather well the previous 2 years, and some business carried over. And in the fall of 59, my boss from Atlanta came up and gave the company a party there in town for an award we'd won. And he and I got to drinking, and I just kept right on drinking, and right on up till Christmas. And, God, it was bad. But Christmas Eve, we were sitting around my office, and you know how drunks are. We got so romantic about Christmas, and so, oh, we were just tearful and emotional about this wonderful time of the year. And had a fireplace going, and one guy on an airplane, he says, we ought to fly over the city. It was snow on the ground. He said, it'll be so beautiful with the lights. You know how we can build this stuff up. And he says, we might even see Santa coming in his sleigh with the toys for his kids. And so we just decided that's what we needed to do. And we drove over to the little town of Chesapeake, Ohio, where he had his plane. And we got in the plane, and the doggone thing wouldn't start. It was too cold. And Don got out to start the plane, and he did with Joe in it. That was the craziest thing. The plane took off. Don fell down, and there's Joe going up and down the runway in the airplane. And I don't know if you know anything about that part of the country, but everything's built on hills. And at the end of this runway, it was about a 100-foot drop. And I didn't know what to do. Don was terribly out of shape. He couldn't catch the plane. I still fussed at him about not taking better care of himself physically. And I got to fooling around with some pedals and wheels and found out I could steer this thing. And I made 4 or 5 passes up and down that runway. I was having a good time by now. And Don still couldn't catch up. And, you know, I found the gas gauges, and it looked like I had enough gas probably to taxi to Easter. And I didn't want to miss Christmas with the children. You know, that's so important. And I stopped the plane. I couldn't figure out how to stop it. Then I just ran it into a hangar. And just the roof of the hangar collapsed. And we had quite a time. Got out of there, and we went by my house twice before either one of us recognized it. I don't know how drunk Don was, but he's in pretty bad shape. My mother-in-law had come in. I managed to cuss her out and go to sleep, and woke up about 2:30 needing a drink bad, and mad because they didn't wake me up to go to midnight church, and they'd already put the children's toys out. I told them they'd just destroyed my Christmas, you know. I hadn't done a thing. I'd just gone to sleep. I don't know. Things got bad. I got moved to Louisville the next year, and my wife laughs about me saying this. She said, I say if I ever had any control over drinking, I lost it all in Louisville. My office was downtown Louisville in the Commonwealth Life Building right across the street from the Brown Hotel, and I had 28 people in this office. And if you want a mess, you put somebody like me in an office, you're supposed to be responsible for 28 people. My day would generally begin at 11 o'clock when I left the office, and I'd go across the street to the Brown Hotel and start drinking. I'd already had something to get me there, and by the time I'm supposed to be back in the office after lunch, I couldn't make it back, and I'd get a room at the Brown, and I generally stayed at the Brown the entire week. We lived in Jeffersontown. That was about 30 minutes away, and I simply couldn't get home. That's all the work. That's all there was to it. When I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, it took me about 3 years to pay off my credit card bill in the Brown Hotel. It took a long time. I must have done a lot of drinking in the Brown Hotel, but that's the way it was. I'd pick up the phone and call the office and tell them that I wouldn't be back this afternoon. I needed to go to Cincinnati. Nobody questioned this for a while because I may have had a reason to be in Cincinnati. But the problem was I'd call them back in about 30 minutes from Cleveland. Half hour late, I'd be in Detroit. And one day I got all the way out to the West Coast by 11 o'clock, and they didn't know how I was traveling that fast. And they thought possibly that my boss in Atlanta would like to know about this new means of transportation. That might be better than selling these crazy business machines. And they told him about it, and I got a letter one Saturday morning when I was at the point of death. It's unfair time to have this happen. I was on the old couch in our living room. I'd gotten home sometime that morning. I don't remember, but I was just laying there. And the kids were back in the room quiet because Daddy was sick. Daddy was sick a lot then. And my wife was trying to keep everything under control. And I think she was glad to see me. I don't know. If she'd had any place to go, I think she would have left. Maybe I'm not giving enough credit. I know I would have if I'd been in that situation. But anyway, the phone rings. And you ever have a phone ring and you know it's a bad phone ring? Just a bad ring. And this was from Western Union, and it said something to the effect that we'd like to have you in Atlanta Monday to discuss your personal conduct. Tickets waiting on you at the airport. Well, now, right away, I didn't want to go to Atlanta. I didn't want to discuss my personal conduct, but this was a command performance, and I had to go. And I finally got down to Atlanta Sunday evening, stayed at the old Henry Grady Hotel. I had this gal get me a call me every couple hours. I'd take a shot, and that's the way I got through the night, to get enough to where I could get up in the morning and get to the office. And I got out there, and this guy, Alton Davis, was a great friend of mine. I worked with him a long time. I made him a lot of money, and I made me a lot of money. But Alton says, "Joe, what in God's name is wrong in Louisville?" And I says, "Did you call me down here to ask me what was wrong in Louisville?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I want to tell you, it's my wife." And he said, "You know, she should have left you at least 10 years ago. I don't know how much sooner than that, but at least 10 years ago. In fact, I don't even know why she married you." And so that ain't going to work. So I start talking about this guy named Al, that used to work for us and quit and was now working with a competitor. And knowing how much stock he placed on company loyalty, I thought this would surely prick up his ears. And you know what he told me? He says, "Joe, Al don't drink and you do. Let's talk about that." And for the next 5 or 6 hours, I went through the meat grinder. I thought I was going to get fired. I really did. But I wasn't worried too much after a few hours. I found out he wasn't going to fire me. Because a couple of years before, I'd quit drinking to save this job. And I was going to quit drinking again. And when I left his office to go to the airport that Monday afternoon, he says, "Joe, good luck to you." And I says, "Alton, I'll never take another drink as long as I live." And he says, "Try to get home sober." The guy knew far more about me than I did myself. You know, if you've been drinking like I have and you've gone 8-9 hours without a drink, it gets pretty rough. The shakes start to come and all these crazy things start to happen. And I bought a couple of drinks in the airport in Atlanta. Got off the plane in Louisville drunk and stayed drunk. This was in January of 1961. I love the definition of an alcoholic as a person who sleeps fitfully between drinks, because that's the way I was living about now. I remember trying to take my wife to see the premiere of Ben-Hur. It came on the market about that time. We went to the theater and sat down, and in a few minutes I told her my stomach was somewhat upset. I'd be back in a moment. I was going to the men's room. I went out and started drinking and forgot she was there. All these things happened to me. Louisville had expressways. I'd never lived in a place that had expressways before, and I used to come to on the expressways. I didn't know where I was, didn't know where I'd been, where I was going. But you know what you learned? You learn it's all right, because you're going to black out again anyway, and you'll show up where you're supposed to be. That's just the way I was living. And it got to be a real mess. And I never will forget my wife when I walked out the side door of that hotel. The Brown Hotel was right next door. And I saw her standing on the marquee of that theater. And then I remembered, my gosh, I brought my wife. And then we got lost going home. It was just a big mess. My boss came up to Louisville about a month later, and he says, "Joe, I can't come back. The place is just going to pot." He says, your replacement's coming back if I have to come back." I tried to quit drinking. The job was no longer the reason to quit drinking. I couldn't quit drinking for this job. You know, I had to quit drinking, but the day was so bad it had to be tomorrow. That's just the way it was. I had to live. And now you're drinking to live. You're not drinking to do anything else. And this is a terrible situation. On the 5th of April, or 4th of April, I called AA in Louisville. And I'll tell you the reason I called him. And some of you may have remembered this guy. His name was Manuel Burke. Johnny may remember. Jack may remember. Manuel was in Eastover when he died. But Manuel started a group in Saluda, where I grew up. And my dad told me the guy, the store he had over there went broke. And I said, why? He says, well, he's never there. I says, where is he? He says, he's out fooling with these old drunks in Saluda County all the time. I said, well, why would anybody do that? He said, well, he's a member of AA. And I don't know if I'd ever heard of AA before. But, you know, you never know when you're the big book somebody else is reading. So when that April night, I picked up the phone, and two guys, Wes and Bob, came out to see me. I still keep up with Wes. I've lost contact with Bob. Wes is still active in the program in Louisville. He's got almost 35 years now. We're still good friends. I remember him very well. I remember Wes talking to me, telling me his story. And when he got through, he says, do you think you're an alcoholic? And, you know, you can't sit up. You've been in all this mess I'm in. And I says, well, I think I must be because of what you told me about yourself. And Wesley says, if you can admit it, he says, you're halfway home. And I wondered what the other half was. You know how we are. We don't want 50%. We want it all. And he says, you got to accept it. And I said, well, that's as easy as admitting it. This is what I'm thinking to myself. But, you know, that comes a couple of years later, really. It took that long for me to accept this thing. I went to AA with them. I got to thinking I was too young to be there before I got there, and they swear it wasn't true, but I think they set it up. They had a guy who was a year younger than I was, automobile salesman. I never did understand how they got to be honest and stay sober in that business, but anyway, Cab had been sober 3 years, and he made the AA talk. He got in at 30, and that impressed me. I went to a lot of meetings in Louisville, but you know, it wasn't long before, I don't know about you, there's another illness in AA that, well, I'm not like that. It's called terminal uniqueness. You know, for the first 3 or 4 weeks I was in AA, I wouldn't drink a cup of coffee because it shook out of the cup. I just wouldn't, I wouldn't have any coffee. And these guys tried to give me orange juice and Kiro syrup. That's what they fed new drunks back then. And I'd get sick on that. I couldn't keep anything down. Now, as many times as I got sick on booze, to go right back to the bottle, it's strange that after getting sick on orange juice and Kiro syrup, I didn't drink orange juice for 15 years after I quit drinking. But it's the truth. But I went to a lot of meetings up there, and I was telling Wes one day after I quit hurting a little bit that I didn't think I was like these other people. I thought I had probably a problem with alcohol, and he said, you just keep coming. We just don't quit us. And I quit the job. I quit drinking to save, and went to work for a company in Iowa. I traveled all of North America for them, right outside of Des Moines. And I was gone 9 weeks the first trip I took with them. And I remember I got home Labor Day of 1961, went to a meeting to see how everybody was. And I remember this little school teacher named Alice saying, Joe, how's AA where you've been? And I says, well, Alice, I don't want my new employer to know I have a problem with alcohol. And she says, sweetheart, don't you know if you don't go to meetings, they find out other ways. And, that just made me mad because the thing that bothered me the most was the fact that I quit drinking 2.5 years by myself before AA. And if you look around a lot of AA meetings in a city in particular, you don't find a whole lot of people in there with over 2.5 years of sobriety. So I didn't see any big deal about it. But I went. I was accepted there. I wasn't accepted in a lot of other places for obvious reasons. I got moved to Memphis. The idea of taking over the Mid-South region, and the guy came up to meet me out of New Orleans and going to work with him. And we went to a fine French restaurant in Memphis, Justine's. It's one of the finest restaurants I've been in my life. And they didn't have whiskey by the drink out there, but this guy had some stuff that shouldn't be drunk. It ought to be used as men's cologne. You just put a little on your face. It's Jack Daniel's Black Label. If you enjoy Jack Black, you know what I'm talking about. And, you know, for you people that are drunks and alcoholics, you don't drink after you get an AA. But for us problem drinkers, it's okay, right? No problem. Just a problem drinking now. And I didn't want Roy to know I wasn't a whole person, and he poured out a drink, and I poured out a drink, and Roy went back to New Orleans that night, and I found out what time the whiskey store closed in Memphis. They closed at 11 o'clock, and I got back about 2 minutes to 11, and I got me a bottle of whiskey, and that started about a 3-week drunk. I got out of there long enough to lose all my money in a high-stakes poker game. It got to be real bad. I wouldn't let the maids in the room to clean up. They disturbed me. I was trying to rest because I had so many important things to do the next day. Always the next day, never now. And this all came to a head the 3rd of November of 1961. I had been complaining for many hours about the speakers in the room. This was an old Holiday Inn, and they had Muzak speakers on the wall. This was before they put televisions in them when they built this. This was a second inn built in the Holiday chain. And I told them I couldn't adjust the volume on the speaker, and since I had so many important things to do the next day, I couldn't get any rest. And finally, about 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, this one little gal, and she should have been fired for treating the guests like that in this hotel, she said she wished I'd quit calling. Those speakers hadn't been hooked up for the last 3 years. And I, you know, that upset me. I took that speaker right off the wall without the benefit of tools, and I went over there and I placed it in the lobby without bothering to open the door. I threw it right through a plate glass window. Now, I got some attention then in a hurry. The police came, and they wasn't very nice. They were not supposed to be like that. They're supposed to be courteous to people, and they wasn't. And for some unknown reason, and I never will forget this guy, his name was Jack Scheibler. He was the innkeeper, and Jack showed up. Why would he come in on Sunday night? He showed up. And he saw what the problem was. He said, we don't want to embarrass you or your company. They keep doing a lot of business with us. He says, go back to your room, and I'll give you until about noon tomorrow to straighten this mess up. If not, I'll send for these fellows to come back and get you. So I went back to the room. And, you know, alcoholics do a lot of deep thinking. We're very profound people, and we get the most profound between 2 and 4 a.m., don't we? Huh? I get a lot of calls about 3 o'clock in the morning. And so about 3 a.m. the next morning, I just didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have any money. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't want to go with the guy with the blue lights on the top of the cars. And I made a supreme sacrifice. I picked up the phone, called Alcoholics Anonymous. And right here is where God, as I understand it, began to take a part in my life, because of all the people in Memphis, a guy by the name of George Davis, and I use George's full name because George has passed on now. George got up, he lived way out in East Memphis, drove 25 miles across town and came into my room about 4:30 and sat there with me the rest of the night. The next morning, here's what George did for me. He went over to the hotel and gave the guy his check for my bill and the damages. He took me home with him, got the fellow to agree to keep me. He wired my company for some additional money. I'd never thought about that. But George and Emmy got me to take a bath, and they took me to my AA meeting in Memphis. That was the fourth day of November of 1961, and that's my dry date as of the night. You know, when I came in Louisville, I was shaky and sick. I was sick this time, but I don't think I was quite as sick as I was in Louisville. I hadn't drank that long, 3 weeks. Wasn't long enough to get you as sick as you can get in 2 years. But something else happened, and this was the obsession to drink, the compulsion to drink, the obsession. The book talks about the allergy that condemns us to die and the obsession that drives us insane. I'm going to tell you, I've never wanted to drink as bad in my life as I wanted to drink then, and I didn't drink. And you want to know why I didn't drink? I think God gives each of us what we need when we need it. He gave me an unholy fear that if I drank again, I was going to die drunk, and I didn't want to do that. I never had that feeling before in my life, but I had that feeling then, and I didn't drink. It was just gritting your teeth and going to meetings. And I wasn't a nice person to have in a meeting. I got in. I had to go. I was there because I had to be, not because I wanted to be. I got in late. I was argumentative, and it's interesting reading the Daily Reflections now. When did old so-and-so start getting better? When he quit arguing. You know, that tells about Joe. But I took issue with about everything. And these old guys would try to talk to me, and I wouldn't buy any of that stuff. And one night I was at George's group out in East Memphis. We'd moved down by then. And the topic of discussion was the last paragraph in the third chapter. You remember what it says? It says there's certain times the alcoholic does not have any effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. That defense must come from a higher power. Well, by golly, they sat around there and talked about that mess, and they finally got around to me, and I told them that I'd been sober outside of AA before I got there long, and most of them had been in AA. I didn't believe all that mess. I thought I was a mature person. Willpower, you know, you go through the whole mess if you talk like I did. And oddly enough, the guy next to me was also named Joe, and he was a doctor at the Veterans Hospital there. Now, the fact that he died late of cirrhosis has nothing to do with this, but he did. Joe concurred with what I had to say, and they, like a lot of AA groups, thanked us for our remarks, and they closed the meeting and they made the announcement there at the end of the meeting. And the kicker in the meeting was that the following Monday evening, a Catholic priest who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was going to talk.
I'd have bought a ticket to hear what a preacher had to say. I'd have bought a ticket. I got there early. I got up on the front row. I didn't want to miss a thing this good father said. And I was, oh, man, was I biased about this thing. I had turned away from the church because things just hadn't gone. And here was a minister now who was a drunk, don't talk. I don't remember what he said except his opening remarks, and I hope I never forget him. He said that he believed that everybody in his life had a cross to bear, and he was glad his was a cross of alcoholism because of all the people that helped him carry it. And I got to thinking, I didn't have anybody to help me carry my cross. Not a one. And, boy, it was kind of bad. And I made the supreme sacrifice that night. I bought a book. Can you believe that? I bought a book. They were selling those things the year before in Louisville for $4, and this night they were $4.50. I thought they were trying to rob me, and I told them so. But I bought a book. And the next day I left, went out of town, and that evening I found myself in a motel room about 100 miles from Memphis. I'm either going to go crazy, get drunk, or give up. It's just one of those days. And maybe you have a day like that. I don't know. But I got that book out. I hadn't even gone out to eat. I sat there and started to read that book. And what I probably did, because this didn't take very long, I know I must have opened it to chapter 3. I read the last paragraph, and sure enough, it said just what those turkeys said the previous Thursday evening. And I turned the page, and I got over to chapter 2, an agnostic. And I want to show you, tell you what I read there. This is a very important thing to me. I began to read down at the bottom of that page, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have discovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically competent. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Ain't a drunk in this room that hadn't asked that question. And the book tells us, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. I want to tell you what happened, Joe. I hadn't done this since I was a kid, and somebody made me do it. I don't know why I did it. I fell on my knees beside a bed. I don't know what I said. I don't know how long I said what I don't know what I said, but I said it. I began to cry. I got up. I went back to bed. The next day, I went to sleep. I slept all night long. Hadn't done that for a long time. The next morning, I got up and I went back to Memphis. I didn't even complete the sales trip. I went to see a guy by the name of Burton Davis, who's also gone now. And I asked Burton if he'd sponsor me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Burton says, Joe, I'm working with so many people, I wouldn't have time to devote to you. I want you to go see Jack. Well, now, Jack was a guy that one night, after I'd made a remark in a meeting, got up and started walking out the door, and the chairman said, Jack, you got the lead man. And Jack says, I wouldn't stay in the room with anybody's phone as that guy. And he got up and walked out, pointed his finger straight at me. Now, let's talk about differences and willingness now, all right? The day before, I would have killed that man if I'd have seen him, if I could have. This day, after Burton told me that, I went to see Jack. I became teachable. And I don't believe we become teachable in this program. I don't believe Joe became teachable until he found a little bit of that higher power in his life. I don't believe of my own will I could have ever done it. I don't believe we can ever take an inventory without having some help from a higher power. I don't think we possibly can. It's too big a job. But I went to see Jack, and Jack talked to me for several hours, and he told me that he thought I'd completed the first three steps. See, I think the kicker of this thing may have been for Joe that he didn't know his life had become unmanageable. I always associated that with what I did when I was drinking, but, you know, if I could have managed my life, I could have managed not to drink. I couldn't do that. So I began to listen to this thing, and we talked about praying, and I was ashamed to tell him I'd prayed the night before. I was actually ashamed of it. And he said, well, okay. He said, I want you to make a contract in the morning. I want you to get up and make a contract with something. I don't care what it is. He says, you make a contract not to drink that day. We used to talk a lot about contracts then. And he says, that evening, he says, you thank whatever you made that contract for not taking a drink that day. He says, I have never seen anybody who made a sincere contract on a daily basis drink that day. I haven't either.
today the contract isn't that much of a contract anymore. It's the meditation that we, Francis, read about and Kim read about. And one of the things that I ask myself and think myself and meditate about so much is that I ask God on a daily basis to keep me aware of His presence in my life, because that's why I'm here tonight, people. It's not because of what I did. It's in spite of what I did. But, you know, I started with Jack on the inventories, and we started with grudges because I didn't have any resentments. And I don't know, this thing, I wrote as much as I could, two or three lines. And we met four times a week to talk about this inventory. And over the next 22 months, I did my fourth and fifth step with Jack. Now, if he had not had to move to California, we never probably would have finished it. But he moved after 22 months. And that's how long my inventory took. And I get frightened sometimes when people come out of treatment centers after 28 days and tell me they've completed five steps in the program. I don't know how they do it. I couldn't do it. This is a soul-searching, gut-rending thing. But I'm going to tell you something that happened to me during that time. I didn't have to make a contract anymore. I began to believe that somebody was listening to what I had to say. And if you never had that feeling, I think you've missed what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. You know, it's a new way of life. The book tells us we ought to be happy, joyous, and free. And I got happy, joyous, and free sometime during this time. And it wasn't a thing I'd done. It's what something had done, what somebody else had done for me. I was real active in the groups in Memphis. I just went to a lot of meetings in Memphis. I made a lot of 12-step calls. Alcoholics Anonymous became the most important thing in my life. And I can tell you tonight as I stand here that being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most incredible experience that one can ever have. You know, I think so many times about something I read in a college literature course. It goes that our birth is but a sleep in the forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life star, has had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar. Not in entire forgetfulness and not in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our home. I think that for me in the formative years of my life and in the years of my alcoholism, I was out there in the wilderness. I was looking for a home. I was looking for a way back to the power I believe that created me. And if it took the throes of alcoholism to do it, tonight I'm telling you I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. I hope all of you read your book. I really believe in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. My story is in there. It's in chapter 3. It's under a name called Fred. Anybody read Fred's story lately? It's a great story. Fred was an accountant in New York, had a little problem with drinking. He talked to AA about it. He didn't think he was as bad as they were. I know none of us have ever said that, but he thought he could do it okay. And they said, okay, Fred, if you ever need us, call us. And they went about their business, and Fred went about his. And like Joe, he didn't drink for a while, but he went to Washington on a business trip. It was successful. At the conclusion of the day, he decided to have a drink before his dinner. In the hotel, he had one, didn't feel anything. He had two, it didn't bother him. He had dinner, went out, went to walk, came back, and the last thing he remembered was going into the bar for a nightcap. And 3 weeks later, he wakes up in a hospital in New York. And the guys came back to see him, and they talked to Fred about the alcoholic mind. Against all reason, against all judgment, this is the insanity of alcoholism. Something will happen if you're by yourself. Only God can remove the obsession to drink. If you have no help, some insane thing will happen. Inconsequential, makes no difference. You'll take the drink despite everything you might know. And Fred said he believed that then. He believed that he had an alcoholic mind. And he said they repeated to him the same proposals that had repeated earlier to him. And he says, I made up my mind to do it. And the words in this paragraph are so significant to me. He says, the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. The moment Joe made up his mind to go through with the process, I haven't wanted a drink since that night in early 1962, and that's a fact. The next sentence of the next paragraph says, quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all of life's problems. That's true with me. What's happened in my life is that I just don't take Joe very seriously anymore. That's all. It's just not that important. I'm glad to be where I am. I'm glad to be alive. I'm grateful for the things in my life. And I just don't worry about a lot of stuff. I don't get excited about a lot of things. I'm just not the same person that walked in this door. My life has changed. Now, I'm going to close this thing up here. Someone read the promises before we started this meeting. And I want to read from the bottom of the page where the promises were concluded about the middle of the page. And I'll tell you what my sponsor told me about those promises now. He says it's a lot easier to work your way in the thinking right than it is to think your way in the working right. You know, we got a lot of intellectuals in AA. And he just told me that's what I had to do, and that's why we worked for those 22 months. But here's the greatest promise in the book for somebody like Joe. It says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off, and here's the promise. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. That is our experience, and that is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And Jack's definition to me of fit spiritual condition was staying out of the driver's seat. I can't anymore run my life today by myself than I could when I got here, and I don't want to. It's such a great change. We came back to Greenville 25 years ago now, settled in Greenville, and had a great time. Melvin and I are very happily married. We've got 5 grandchildren. 2 weeks ago, we had a little granddaughter. That's the first rose among thorns. We've had 4 grandsons. That's what she said. I thought we ought to have at least 1 girl. But life's good. Life's real good. I'm as active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous today as I was the day I got here. Someone asked me once how long you have to go to AA. And some little gal got up and talked at our group one night and told me, she says, you have to go till you want to go, and then you're just there, but you don't have to be. And, you know, I want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Our group meets tonight. It meets Thursday night. Monday night, Margaret and 6 or 7 of us do a little study group in my office at 6 o'clock. It's just a good way to live. I can't think of a better way to live. I believe the promises that are written come true, and life's just good. It's just really good, as long as I stay out of the driver's seat. Alan and I share a common thing in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We like to close our talk a certain way. And I remember this talk, remember this passage. And I remember a gal named Miriam out in Memphis who just couldn't get sober. Miriam was a very refined little southern lady who only drank a little sherry, but of course sometimes she forgot how much she drank and couldn't get out of that lounge chair for a week at a time. And she'd start telephoning. And she'd telephone the club, and we'd go out to see her. She wouldn't go to a meeting. She wanted the formula. Always the formula. And, you know, you don't waste a lot of time in meetings. Just give me the formula. And so we all talked to Muriel in our infinite wisdom, and I don't know if Muriel ever got sober or not. She wasn't when I left. And I kind of doubt it, as long as she was just looking for a formula. But the closing part of the 11th chapter tells us what the formula is. It says our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. And here's another promise. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. And now for Miriam, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge your road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.
Joe, thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. It's good to hear you again. It's been a while. Final thing we got on this thing is the chip system. And we got to pass the basket too for us over with. And Wayne is going to do the chip system for us. We have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses. Ask only that alcoholics contribute. Let's start down this way. Wayne?
I am Wayne Laxman, and I am an alcoholic. All right, everybody. I'm sober today, but grace of God and program of Alcoholics Anonymous said I am grateful. Hazel Wallace, congratulations. I like to say this. When I first got in AA, for about 2 years, I was faithful at Johnston. Every Tuesday night, I'd come to Johnston. And I got away from coming up here because I make about 3 meetings a week. But for some reason, tonight, and I know the reason now, I came to this meeting, and the reason I think I came was God sent me here to hear some of the things that Joe had to say tonight. Joe, I appreciate it. In this group, as most groups, we have a chip system. Won't keep you sober, it's just a reminder of what you're trying to do. We ask if you have a problem with alcohol, when you join the fellowship, we ask you to pick up a white chip. Carry it for 30 days, and we'll give you a silver chip. Silver for 60 more days, 3 months, and you got a red. Red for 3 more months, a total of 6 months, you got a yellow chip. A yellow for 3 more months, 9 months, and you got a green. A green for 3 more months, 365 days, and I like to think about 10,000 nights, and you've got this blue chip. We ask why you're carrying any of these chips. If you have a desire to drink, please call someone. White chip has a telephone number in the back of it. If you can't, don't want to call somebody, just go ahead and break your chip and have you drunk and come on back. You're always welcome. Is anyone here tonight like to pick up a white chip and join the fellowship? Has anyone been successful for 30 days? 3 months? 6 months? 9 months? Any birthdays? Water got here again. Any second thoughts on the white chip? Thank you very much.
I want to say something for a while and get up here. Got some pecans and candy over here. Come on, Alex.
Go ahead.
I'm through. For the people who want the cash, I'm home with them. And Hazel's got some food over here. And she'd like for Joe and Margaret to get in line first so they can get back to Greenville. We've got to be back at 12 o'clock. They got goodie bags over there. And I still love everybody.
Are you running for state delegate? I think Wallace is running politics or something. He's given away enough plaques and pencils and pens and pecans to been elected 4 times already. At least, absolutely. This has been a joy. And Wallace, again, thank you and congratulations to you, Hazel, and both of you. It's been a pleasure to be around you these few years, and especially since you got your hearing aid. I don't know of anything. Did we leave out anything? If we will, let's all join hands and close with the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you.
Well, also, I have some cakes in a few minutes, but hey, please.